Okay, welcome everybody to Savitri on Infinite Conversations. I'm here with Andrea, Jeffrey Jen, and John Robert. I'm Marco. And today we're moving on to the next book, book six, the Book of Fate, and Canto one, the Word of Fate. And we'll begin with a meditation and then read in the order of Andrea, Jeffrey Jen, John Robert, and myself. I'll ring a bell if there isn't one handy, but if you have one, go ahead, Jeffrey.
Oh, I have to turn the sound up.
The Book of Fate, Canto One, the Word of Fate. In silent bounds, bordering the mortal's plane, crossing a wide expanse of brilliant peace, Narad, the heavenly sage from paradise, came chanting through the large and lustrous air. Attracted by the golden summer earth that lay beneath him like a glowing bowl, tilted upon a table of the gods, turning as if moved round by an unseen hand to catch the warmth and blaze of a small sun, he passed from the immortals' happy paths to a world of toil and quest and grief and hope, to these rooms of the seesaw game of death with life. Across an intangible border of soul space, he passed from mind into material things, amid the inventions of the inconscient self and the workings of a blind somnambulous force. Below him, circling, burned the myriad suns. He bore the ripples of the etheric sea, a primal air, brought the first joy of touch. The secret spirit drew its mighty breath, contracting and expanding this huge world in its formidable circuit through the void. The secret might of the creative fire displayed its triple power to build and form its infinitesimal wave sparks, weaving dance, its nebulous units, grounding shape and mass, magic foundation of and pattern of a world, its radiance bursting into the light of stars. He felt a sap of life, a sap of death. Into solid matter's dense communion, plunging, and its obscure oneness of forms, he shared with a dumb spirit identity.
He beheld the cosmic being at his task. His eyes measured the spaces, gauged the depths. His inner gaze, the movements of the soul. He saw the eternal labor of the gods and looked upon the life of beasts and men. A change now fell upon the singer's mood. A rapture and a pathos moved his voice. He sang no more of light that never wanes, and oneness and pure everlasting bliss. He sang no more the deathless heart of love. His chant was a hymn of ignorance and fate. He sang the name of Vishnu and the birth and joy and passion of the mystic world, and how the stars were made and life began and the mute region stirred with a throb of a soul. He sang the inconscient and its secret self, its power omnipotent, knowing not what it does, all shaping without will or thought or sense, its blind, unerring, occult mystery, and darkness yearning towards the eternal light, and love that broods within the dim abyss and waits the answer of the human heart, and death that climbs to immortality. He sang of the truth that cries from night's blind deeps, and the mother wisdom hid in nature's breast, and the eye and the idea that through her dumbness works, and the miracle of her transforming hands, of life that slumbers in the stone and sun and mind subliminal in mindless life, and the consciousness that wakes in beasts and men. He sang of the glory and marvel still to be born, of Godhead throwing off it at last its veil, of bodies made divine and life made bliss, immortal sweetness clasping immortal might, heart sensing heart, thought looking straight at thought, and the delight when every barrier falls, and the transfiguration and the ecstasy.
And as he sang, the demons wept with joy, foreseeing the end of their long, dreadful task, and the defeat for which they hoped in vain, and glad release from their self-chosen doom, and return into the one from whom they came. He who has conquered the immortal seats came down to men on earth, the man divine. As darts a lightning streak, a glory fell nearing until the rapt eyes of the sage looked out from luminous cloud, and strangely limbed, his face a beautiful mask of antique joy, appearing in light, descended where arose King Ashwapati's palace to the winds in Madra, flowering up in delicate stone. There welcoming him the sage and thoughtful king, at his side a creature beautiful, passionate, wise, aspiring like a sacrificial flame skyward from its earth seat through luminous air, Queen Browed, the human mother of Savitri. There for an hour untouched by the earth's siege, they ceased from common life and care, and sat inclining to the high and rhythmic voice, while in his measured chant, the heavenly seer spoke of the toils of men and what the gods strive for on earth, and joy that throbs behind the marvel and the mystery of pain. He sang to them of the lotus heart of love, with all its thousand luminous buds of truth, which quivering sleeps unveiled by apparent things. It trembles at each touch. It strives to wake, and one day it shall hear a blissful voice, and in the garden of the spouse shall bloom when she is seized by her discovered Lord.
A mighty shuddering coil of ecstasy crept through the deep heart of the universe. Out of her matter's stupor, her mind's dreams, she woke. She looked upon God's unveiled face. Why don't we pause there, as we've been doing during our first readings? So this is a new scene. As I understand it, we've shifted from Savitri and Satyavan, and now we're with King Ashwapati and his queen. But we're introduced at first to Narad, who I just learned of earlier today when I was preparing, a god, kind of traveling singer, maybe an Orpheus kind of figure, but someone who sings and prophesies for the benefit of all, but is a little bit of a trickster as well. And so we're just really in a setting the scene stage. There's yet a complex exchange to come between the characters as Savitri makes her way back and is in the flush, the flush of love, but is about to learn something of the fate of her beloved and of her love. So that's my understanding of what's happening, but I'm just a first-time reader, so I'd love to hear what you all think.
So there's a line I really love. So it feels like that the universe knows that his coming down has to do with a auspicious event, right, of the Savitri and Satyavan meeting. And so at the top of 417, and as he sang, the demons wept with joy, foreseeing the end of their long, dreadful task and the defeat for which they hoped in vain, and glad release from their self-chosen doom and return into the one from whom they came. That is just such a remarkable Is that the purpose of the demons is actually to bring the awareness of the one. They bring us challenges, so we wake up, but it's a dreadful task. And they are looking forward to their release. I just love that line.
It's like a transmutation that seems also to occur by the effect or the work of Narad's music.
I also found, I don't disagree with you, Marco, that it is a kind of taking stock of where we are in order to prepare the next stuff. But there is a passion in this thing, in this text, even this opening text. I read it passionately, so maybe it's me, I don't know, but I think it's actually in the text, not just me.
I concur. I know it's there, but I know that there's more to come. So.
Yes.
I like that Sri Aurobindo prefigures, or actually the results of his yoga on the bottom of page 416 in Narad's song. He sang of the glory and marvel still to be born, of Godhead throwing off at last its veil, of bodies made divine and life made bliss, immortal sweetness clasping immortal might, heart sensing heart, and so on. So it's right before what he says happens to the demons. And he's talking about the transformation that Sri Aurobindo and Mother forecast.
The delight when every barrier falls, and the transfiguration and the ecstasy.
Could anyone say anything more about Narad?
I'm certainly not an expert on it, but my sense is he's a little bit like Mercury in the Roman pantheon. He's a messenger. He comes from the gods. He's a god, but he's a messenger that brings tidings from the gods to the mortals.
That makes sense. Shall I go on? Okay. Passion. Even as he sang, and rapture stole through earth time and caught the heavens, came with a call of hooves, as of her swift heart hastening, Savitri. Her radiant tread glimmered across the floor. A happy wonder in her fathomless gaze, changed by the halo of her love, she came. Her eyes rich with a shining mist of joy, as one who comes from a heavenly embassy, discharging the proud mission of her heart, one carrying the sanction of the gods to her love and its luminous eternity. She stood before her mighty father's throne and, eager for beauty on discovered earth, transformed and new in her heart's miracle light, saw like a rose of marvel, worshiping the fire-tinged sweetness of the Son of Heaven. He flung on her his vast immortal look, his inner gaze surrounded her with its light, and raining back knowledge from his immortal lips, he cried to her, "Who is this that comes, the bride, the flame-born, and round her illumined head pouring their lights, her hymeneal pomps move flashing about her, From what green glimmer of glades retreating into dewy silences, or half-seen verge of waters, moon betrayed, bring'st thou this glory of enchanted eyes? Earth has gold-hued expanses, shadowy hills that cowl their dreaming phantom heads in night, and guarded in a cloistral joy of woods, screened banks sink down into felicity, seized by the curved, incessant, yearning hands and ripple passion of the upgazing stream. Amid cool-lipped murmurs of its pure embrace, they lose their souls on beds of trembling reeds.
And all these are mysterious presences in which some spirit's immortal bliss is felt, and they betray the earth-born heart to joy. There hast thou paused, and marveling, born eyes unknown, or heard a voice that forced thy life to strain its rapture through thy listening soul? Or if my thought could trust this shimmering gaze, it would say thou hast not drunk from an earthly cup, but stepping through azure curtains of the noon, thou wast surrounded on a magic verge in brighter countries than men's eyes can bear. Assailed by trooping voices of delight, and seized mid a sunlit glamour of the boughs in fairy woods, let down the gleaming slopes of Gandhamadan, where the Apsaras roam. Thy limbs have shared the sports which none has seen, and in god haunts thy human footsteps strayed. Thy mortal bosom quivered with god's speech, and thy soul answered to a word unknown. What feet of gods, what ravishing flutes of heaven have thrilled high melodies round from near and far, approaching through the soft and reveling air, which still surprised thou hearest. They have fed thy silence on some red, strange ecstasied fruit, and thou hast trod the dim moon peaks of bliss. Reveal, O winged with light, whence thou hast flown, hastening bright-hued through the green tangled earth, thy body rhythmical with the spring bird's call. The empty roses of thy hands are filled only with their own beauty and the thrill of a remembered clasp. And in thee glows a heavenly jar, the firm, deep-honeyed heart, new bringing with a sweet and nectarous wine. Thou hast not spoken with the kings of pain.
Life's perilous music rings yet to thy ear, far melodied, rapid and grand as centaur's song, or soft as water plashing amid the hills, or mighty as a great chant of many winds. Moon bright, thou livest in thy inner bliss. Thou comest like a silver deer through groves of coral flowers and buds of glowing dreams, or fleest like a wind goddess through leaves, or roamest, O ruby-eyed and snow-winged dove, flitting through thickets of thy pure desires in the unwounded beauty of thy soul. These things are only images of thy earth, but truest truth of that which in thee sleeps. For such is thy spirit, a sister of the gods, thy earthly body lovely to the eyes, and thou art kin in joy to heaven's sons. O thou who hast come to this great perilous world, now only seen through the splendor of thy dreams, where hardly love and beauty can live safe, thyself a being dangerously great, a soul alone in a golden house of thought, has lived walled in by the safety of thy dreams. On heights of happiness, leaving doom asleep who hunts unseen the unconscious lives of men. If thy heart could live locked in the ideal's gold, as high, as happy might thy waking be, for all, if for all time doom could be left to sleep. He spoke, but held his knowledge back from words, as a cloud plays with lightning's vivid laugh, but still holds back the thunder in its heart. Only he let bright images escape. His speech, like glimmering music, veiled his thoughts, as a wind flatters the bright summer air. Pitiful to mortals, only to them it spoke of living beauty and of present bliss. He hid in his all-knowing mind the rest.
To those who hearken to his celestial voice, the veil heaven's pity throws on future pain, and the immortal sanction seemed of endless joy. But Ashwapati answered to the seer. His listening mind had marked the dubious close. An ominous shadow felt behind the words. But calm like one who ever sits facing fate, here amid the dangerous contours of Earth's life, he answered covert thought with guarded speech. O deathless sage who knowest all things here, if I could read by the ray of my own wish through the carved shield of symbol images which thou hast thrown before thy heavenly mind, I might see the steps of a young godlike life happily beginning luminous eyed on earth. Between the unknowable and the unseen, born on the borders of two wonder worlds, it flames out symbols of the infinite and lives in a great light of inner suns. For it has read and broken the wizard seals. It has drunk of the immortal's wells of joy. It has looked across the jewel bars of heaven. It has entered the aspiring secrecy. It sees beyond terrestrial common things and communes with the powers that builds the worlds, till through the shining gates and mystic streets of the city of lapis lazuli and pearl, proud deeds step forth, a rank and march of gods. Although in pauses our human lives, Earth keeps for man some short and perfect hours when the inconstant tread of time can seem the eternal moment which the deathless live. Yet rare that touch upon the mortal's world. Hardly a soul and body here are born in the fierce, difficult movement of the stars, whose life can keep the paradisal note, its rhythm repeat the many-toned melody tirelessly throbbing through the rapturous air, caught in the song that sways the Apsara's limbs when she floats, gleaming like a cloud of light, a wave of joy on heaven's moonstone floor.
Behold this image cast by light and love, a stanza of the ardor of the gods, perfectly rhymed, a pillared ripple of gold. Her body, like a brimmed pitcher of delight, shaped in a splendor of gold-colored bronze, as if to seize Earth's truth of hidden bliss. Dream-made, illumined mirrors are her eyes, draped subtly in a slumberous fringe of jet, retaining heaven's reflections in their depths. Even as her body, such is she within. Heaven's lustrous mornings gloriously recur, like drops of fire upon a silver page, in her young spirit, yet untouched with tears. All beautiful things eternal seem and new to virgin wonder in her crystal soul. The unchanging blue reveals its spacious thought. Marvelous, the moon floats on through wondering skies. Earth's flowers spring up and laugh at time and death. The charmed mutations of the enchanter life race like bright children past the smiling hours. If but this joy of life could last, not nor pain throw its bronze note into her rhythmed days. Behold her, singer with the prescient gaze, and let thy blessing chant that this fair child shall pour the nectar of a sorrowless life around her from her lucid heart of love. Heal with her bliss the tired breast of earth and cast like a happy snare felicity. As grows the great and golden bounteous tree, flowering by Alakananda's murmuring waves, where with enamored speed the waters run, lisping and babbling to the splendor of morn, and cling with lyric laughter round the knees of heaven's daughters, dripping magic rain, pearl bright from moon gold limbs and cloudy hair. So are her dawns like jeweled leaves of light. So casts she her felicity on men.
A flame of radiant happiness she was born, and surely will that flame set earth alight. Doom surely will see her pass and say no word. But too often here the careless mother leaves her chosen in the envious hands of fate. The harp of God falls mute, its call to bliss discouraged fails mid earth's unhappy sounds. The strings of the siren ecstasy cry not here, or soon are silenced in the human heart. Of sorrow's songs we have enough. Bid once her glad and griefless days bring heaven here, or must fire always test the great of soul? Along the dreadful causeway of the gods, armored with love and faith and sacred joy, a traveler to the eternal's house, once let unwounded pass a mortal life. But Narad answered not. Silent he sat, knowing that words are vain and fate is Lord. He looked into the unseen with seeing eyes, then dallying with the mortal's ignorance like one who knows not, questioning, he cried, on what high mission went her hastening wheels? Whence came she with this glory in her heart and paradise made visible in her eyes? What sudden God has met? What face supreme? To whom the king, the red Asoka, watched her going forth, which now sees her return. Arisen into an air of flaming dawn, like a bright bird tired of her lonely branch, to find her own Lord. Since to her on earth he came not yet, this sweetness wandered forth, cleaving her way with the beat of her rapid wings.
Led by a distant call, her vague swift flight threaded the summer morns and sunlit lands. The happy rest her burdened lashes keep, and these charmed guardian lips hold treasured still. Virgin, who comest perfectly by joy, perfected by joy, reveal the name thy sudden heartbeats learned. Whom hast thou chosen, kingliest among men? And Savitri answered with her still calm voice, as one who speaks beneath the eyes of fate. Father and King, I have carried out thy will. One whom I sought, I found in distant lands. I have obeyed my heart. I have heard its call. On the borders of a dreaming wilderness, mid Shalwa's giant hills and brooding woods, in his thatched hermitage, Jumatsena dwells, blind, exiled, outcast, once a mighty king. The son of Jumatsena, Satyavan, I have met on the wild forest's lonely verge. My father, I have chosen. This is done. Astonished, all sat silent for a space. Then Ashwapati looked within and saw a heavy shadow float above the name, chased by a sudden and stupendous light. He looked into his daughter's eyes and spoke, "Well hast thou done, and I approve thy choice. If this is all, then all is surely well. If there is more, then all can still be well. Whether it seem good or evil to men's eyes, only for good the secret will can work. Our destiny is written in double terms. Through nature's contraries, we draw nearer God. Out of the darkness, we still grow to light. Death is our road to immortality."
Cry woe, cry woe, the world's lost voices wail, yet conquers the eternal good at last. Then might the sage have spoken, but the king in haste broke out and stayed the dangerous word. O singer of the ultimate ecstasy, lend not a dangerous vision to the blind, because by native right thou hast seen clear. Impose not on the mortal's tremulous breast the dire ordeal that foreknowledge brings. Demand not now the Godhead in our acts. Here are not happy peaks the heaven nymphs roam, or Koilas or Vaikuntha's starry stair. Abrupt, jagged hills only the mighty climb are here, where few dare even think to rise. Far voices call down from the dizzy rocks. Chill, slippery, precipitous are the paths. Too hard the gods are with man's fragile race. In their large heavens they dwell exempt from fate, and they forget the wounded feet of man, his limbs that faint beneath the whips of grief, his heart that hears the tread of time and death. The future's road is hid from mortal sight. He moves towards a veiled and secret face. To light one step in front is all his hope, and only for a little strength he asks to meet the riddle of his shrouded fate. Awaited by a vague and half-seen force, aware of danger to his uncertain hours, he guards his flickering yearnings from her breath. He feels not when the dreadful fingers close around him, with the grasp none can elude. If thou canst loose her grip, then only speak. Perhaps from the iron snare there is escape. Our mind perhaps deceives us with its words and gives the name of doom to our own choice. Perhaps the blindness of our will is fate. He said, and Narad answered not the king.
But now the queen, alarmed, lifted her voice. "Oh, seer, thy bright arrival has been timed to this high moment of a happy life, then let the speech benign of griefless fears confirm this blithe conjunction of two stars and sanction joy with thy celestial voice. Here drag not in the peril of our thoughts. Let not our words create the doom they fear. Here is no cause for dread, no chance for grief to raise her ominous head and stare at love. A single spirit in a multitude. Happy is Satyavan mid earthly men, whom Savitri has chosen for her mate, and fortunate the forest hermitage, where leaving her palace and riches and a throne, my Savitri will dwell and bring in heaven. Then let thy blessing put the immortal seal on these bright lives' unstained felicity, pushing the ominous shadow from their days. Too heavy falls a shadow on man's heart. It dares not be too happy upon earth. It dreads the blow dogging too vivid joys, a lash unseen in fate's extended hand, the danger lurking in fortune's proud extremes, an irony in life's indulgent smile, and trembles at the laughter of the gods. Or if crouches unseen a panther doom, if wings of evil brood above that house, then also speak that we may turn aside and rescue our lives from hazard of wayward, wayside doom, and chance entanglement of an alien fate. And Narad slowly answered to the queen, what help is in prevision to the driven? Safe doors cry opening near, the doom pass on. Let me read that line again and just end at the last, next page. What help is in prevision to the driven? Safe doors cry opening near, the doomed pass on. A future knowledge is an added pain, a torturing burden and a fruitless light on the enormous scene that fate has built.
The eternal poet, universal mind, has paged each line of his imperial act. Invisible the giant actor's tread, and man lives like some secret player's mask. He knows not even what his lips shall speak. For a mysterious power compels his steps, and life is stronger than his trembling soul. None can refuse what the stark force demands. Her eyes are fixed upon her mighty aim. No cry or prayer can turn her from her path. She has leaped an arrow from the bow of God. His words were theirs who live unforced to grieve and help by calm the swaying wheels of life and the long restlessness of transient things and the trouble and passion of the unquiet world. As though her own bosom were pierced, the mother saw the ancient human sentence strike her child. Her sweetness that deserved another fate, only a larger measure given of tears. Aspiring to the nature of the gods, a mind proof armored, mailed in mighty thoughts, a will entire couchant behind wisdom's shield, though to still heavens of knowledge she had risen, though calm and wise and Aswapati's queen, human was she still and opened her doors to grief. The stony-eyed injustice she accused of the marble godhead of inflexible law, nor sought the strength extreme adversity brings to lives that stand erect and front the world power. Her heart appealed against the impartial judge, taxed with perversity the impersonal one. Her tranquil spirit she called not to her aid, but as a common man beneath his load grows faint and breathes his pain in ignorant words, so now she arraigned the world's impassive will. What stealthy doom has crept across her path, emerging from the dark forest's sullen heart? What evil thing stood smiling by the way and wore the beauty of the Shalva boy?
Perhaps he came an enemy from her past, armed with the hidden force of ancient wrongs, himself unknowing, and seized her unknown. Here dreadfully entangled love and hate meet us blind wanderers mid the perils of time. Our days are linked of a disastrous chain. Necessity avenges casual steps. Old cruelties come back unrecognized, and gods make use of our forgotten deeds. Yet all in vain the bitter law was made. Our own minds are the justicers of doom. For nothing have we learned, but still repeat our stark misuse of self and other souls. There are dire alchemies of the human heart, and fallen from his ethereal element, love darkens to the spirit of nether gods. The dreadful angel, angry with his joys, woundingly sweet, he cannot yet forego, is pitiless to the goal, to the soul his gaze disarmed. He visits with his own pangs his quivering prey, forcing us to cling enamored to his grip, as if in love with our own agony. This is one poignant misery in the world, and grief has other lassos for our life. Our sympathies become our torturers. Strength have I my own punishment to bear, knowing it just, but on this earth perplexed, smitten in the sorrow of scourged and helpless things, often it faints to meet other suffering eyes. We are not as the gods who know not grief and look impassive on a suffering world. Come, they gaze down on the little human scene and the short-lived passion crossing mortal hearts.
An ancient tale of woe can move us still. We keep the ache of breasts that breathe no more. We are shaken by the sight of human pain and share the miseries that others feel. Ours not the passionless lids that cannot age. Too hard for us is heaven's indifference. Our own tragedies are not enough for us. All pathos and all sufferings we make ours. We have sorrow for a greatness passed away and feel the touch of tears in mortal things. Even a stranger's anguish rends my heart. And this, O Narad, is my well-loved child. Hide not from us our doom, if doom is ours. This is the worst, an unknown face of fate. A terror ominous, mute, felt more than seen behind our seat by day, our couch by night. A fate lurking in the shadow of our hearts, the anguish of the unseen that waits to strike. To know is best, however hard to bear. Then cried the sage, piercing the mother's heart, forcing to steel the will of Savitri. His words set free the spring of cosmic fate. The great gods use the pain of human hearts as a sharp axe to hew their cosmic road. They squander lavishly men's blood and tears for a moment's purpose in their fateful work. This cosmic nature's balance is not ours, nor the mystic measure of her need and use. A single word lets loose vast agencies. A casual act determines the world's fate. So now he set free destiny in that hour. The truth thou hast claimed, I give to thee the truth. A marvel of the meeting earth and heavens is he whom Savitri has chosen mid men. His figure is the front of nature's march. His single being excels the works of time.
A sapphire cutting from the sleep of heaven. Delightful is the soul of Satyavan. A ray out of the rapturous infinite, a silence waking to a hymn of joy. A divinity and kingliness gird his brow. His eyes keep a memory from a world of bliss. As brilliant as a lonely moon in heaven, gentle like the sweet bud that spring desires, pure like a stream that kisses silent banks, he takes with bright surprise spirit and sense. A living knot of golden paradise, a blue immense, he leans to the longing world, time's joy borrowed out of eternity, a star of splendor or a rose of bliss. In him, soul and nature, equal presences, balance and fuse in a wide harmony. The happy in their bright ether have not hearts more sweet and true than this of mortal make that takes all joy as the world's native gift and to all gives joy as the world's natural right. His speech carries a light of inner truth and a large-eyed communion with the power in common things has made veilless his mind, a seer in earth shapes of garbless deity. A tranquil breath of sky, windless and still, watching the world like a mind of unplumbed thought. A silent space, musing and luminous, uncovered by the morning to delight. A green tangle of trees upon a happy hill, made into a murmuring nest by southern winds. These are his images and parallels, his kin in beauty, and in depth his peers. A will to climb lifts a delight to live, heaven's height companion of earth beauty's charm, an aspiration to the immortal's air, lain on the lap of mortal ecstasy.
His sweetness and his joy attract all hearts to live with his own in a glad tenancy. His strength is like a tower built to reach heaven, a godhead quarried from the stones of life. O loss, if death into its elements of which his gracious envelope was built, shatter this vase before it breathes its sweets, as if earth could not keep too long from heaven, a treasure thus unique, loaned by the gods, a being so rare, of so divine a make. In one brief year, when this bright hour flies back, and perches careless on a branch of time, this sovereign glory ends heaven lent to earth. This splendor vanishes from the mortal's sky. Heaven's greatness came, but was too great to stay. 12 swift winged months are given to him and her, this day returning, Satyavan must die. A lightning bright and nude, the sentence fell. But the queen cried, vain then can be heaven's grace. Heaven mocks us with the brilliance of its gifts, for death is a cupbearer of the wine of too brief joy, held up to mortal lips for a passionate moment by the careless gods. But I reject the grace and the mockery. Mounting thy car, go forth, O Savitri, and travel once more through the peopled lands. Alas, in the green gladness of the woods, thy heart has stooped to a misleading call. Choose once again and leave this fated head. Death is the gardener of this wonder tree. Love's sweetness sleeps in his pale marble hand. Advancing in a honeyed line but closed, a little joy would buy too bitter an end. Plead not thy choice, for death has made it vain.
Thy youth and radiance were not born to lie, a casket void dropped in a careless soil. A choice less rare may call a happier fate. But Savitri answered from her violent heart. Her voice was calm, her face was fixed like steel. Once my heart chose and chooses not again, the word I have spoken can never be erased. It is written in the record book of God, and truth once uttered from the earth's air effaced. My mind forgotten sounds immortally forever in the memory of time. Once the dice fall thrown by the hand of fate in an eternal moment of the gods, my heart has sealed its troth to Satyavan. Its signature adverse fate cannot efface. Its seal, not fate, not death, nor time, dissolve. Those who shall part, who have grown one being within, death's grip can break our bodies, not our souls. If death take him, I too know how to die. Let faith do with me what she will or can. I am stronger than death and greater than my fate. My love shall outlast the world. Doom falls from me, helpless against my immortality. Fate's law may change, but not my spirit's will. An adamant will, she cast her speech like bronze, but in the queen's mind, listening, her words rang like the voice of a self-chosen doom, denying every issue of escape. To her own despair, answer the mother made, as one she cried who in her heavy heart labors amid the sobbing of her hopes to wake a note of help from sadder strings. O child, in the magnificence of thy soul, dwelling on the border of a greater world and dazzled by thy superhuman thoughts, thou lend'st eternity to a mortal hope. Here on this mutable and ignorant earth, who is the lover and who is the friend?
All passes here. Nothing remains the same. None is for any on this transient globe. He whom thou lovest now, a stranger came, and into a far strangeness shall depart. His moments part once done upon life's stage, which for a time was given him from within, to other scenes he moves, and other players, and laughs and weeps mid faces new, unknown. The body thou hast loved is cast away amidst the brute, unchanging stuff of worlds to indifferent, mighty nature, and becomes crude matter for the joy of others' lives. But for our souls, upon the wheel of God forever turning, they arrive and go, married and sundered in the magic round of the great dancer of the boundless dance. Our emotions are but high and dying notes of his wild music, changed compellingly by the passionate movements of a seeking heart in the inconstant links of hour with hour. To call down heaven's distant answering song, to cry to an unseized bliss is all we dare. Once seized, we lose the heavenly music's sense. Too near, the rhythmic cry has fled or failed. All sweetnesses are baffling symbols here. Love dies before the lover in our breast. Our joys are perfumes in a brittle vase. Oh, then what wreck is this upon time's sea to spread life's sails to the hurricane desire and call for pilot the unseeing heart? O child, wilt thou proclaim, wilt thou then follow against the law that is the eternal will, the autarky of the rash Titan's mood, to whom his own fierce will is the one law in a world where truth is not, nor light, nor God?
Only the gods can speak what now thou speakest. Thou who art human, think not like a god. For man, below the god, above the brute, is given the calm reason as his guide. He is not driven by an unthinking will, as are the actions of the bird and beast. He is not moved by stark necessity, like the senseless motion of inconscient things. The giants and the titans' furious march climbs to usurp the kingdom of the gods, or skirts the demon magnitudes of hell. In the unreflecting passion of their hearts, they dash their lives against the eternal law and fall and break by their own violent mass. The middle path is made for thinking man. To choose his steps by reason's vigilant light, to choose his path among the many paths is given him, for each his difficult goal, hewn out of infinite possibility. Leave not thy goal to follow a beautiful face. Only when thou hast climbed above thy mind and livest in the calm vastness of the One, can love be eternal in the eternal bliss, and love divine replace the human tie. There is a shrouded law, an austere force. It bids thee strengthen thy undying spirit. It offers its severe benignancies of work and thought and measured grave delight as steps to climb to God's far secret heights. Then is our life a tranquil pilgrimage, each year a mile upon the heavenly way. Each dawn opens into a larger light. Thy acts are thy helpers. All events are signs. Waking and sleep are opportunities given to thee by an immortal power.
So canst thou raise thy pure, unvanquished spirit, till spread to heaven in a wide vesper calm, indifferent and gentle as the sky, it greatens slowly into timeless peace. But Savitri replied with steadfast eyes, my will is part of the eternal will. My fate is what my spirit's strength can make. My fate is what my spirit's strength can bear. My strength is not the Titans, it is God's. I have discovered my glad reality beyond my body in another's being. I have found the deep, unchanging soul of love. then how shall I desire a lonely good, or slay, aspiring to white vacant peace, the endless hope that made my soul spring forth out of its infinite solitude and sleep? My spirit has glimpsed the glory for which it came, the beating of one vast heart in the flame of things, my eternity clasped by his eternity, and tireless of the sweet abysms of time, deep possibility always to love. This is first, last joy, and to its throb the riches of a thousand fortunate years are poverty. Nothing to me are death and grief, or ordinary lives and happy days. And what to me are common souls of men, or eyes and lips that are not Satyavans? I have no need to draw back from his arms and the discovered paradise of his love and journey into still infinity. Only now for my soul in Satyavan, I treasure the rich occasion of my birth. In sunlight and a dream of emerald ways, I shall walk with him like gods in paradise. If for a year, that year is all my life. And yet I know this is not all my fate, only to live and love a while and die.
For I know now why my spirit came on earth, and who I am, and who he is I love. I have looked at him from my immortal self. I have seen God smile at me in Satyavan. I have seen the eternal in a human face. Then none could answer to her words. Silent they sat and looked into the eyes of fate. End of Canto 1. So I noticed when I was reading, when we were reading, it started off this sort of very happy kind of stuff, and then it went very dark, and I thought, why are we reading all this dark stuff? And then it went happy again, and then we got the news about Satyavan and the 1 year, and then we realized why we had the dark stuff to prepare us to deal with this stuff, right? So it was kind of interesting the way he structured that whole canto, found.
I think it's interesting to realize that we are now 1 year before Canto 1, Book 1, Canto 1. Because in that canto, it ends with the words, "This is the day that Satyavan must die." So since we had that canto, we've went back in time and we've been slowly moving back towards that time. Now we're 1 year away from it. It's 1 year in the future.
That's pretty cool. also, in responding to Jeffrey Jen's observation, I think that this whole scene, as I referred to it before we started, is one of the most dramatic. It has this interplay between multiple characters. Usually we're following one perspective in Savitri, and occasionally we have a dialogue. But here there's a whole family drama with, in essence, the parents of Savitri pleading for her case or for her, you know, for her well-being. They have insight into fate. They can sense that that her happiness is going to be bound by mortal realities or by earthly realities. And it's almost like it reminds me of like a young person coming home from college or something and being like head over heels in love with somebody and not maybe appreciating the larger time and the transience, the ephemerality of that relationship, and the parents, you know, wanting not to burst their bubble on the one hand and wanting to protect their heart, but also wanting to, I guess, cushion the, you know, like the inevitable. But that's not exactly Savitri's place. I mean, she's contradicting, or she's making a counter argument, essentially, about the nature of her love, and so this like whole scene, this exchange between Narad and Ashwapati and the queen, and the negotiation that they kind of have, and then the outrage that she expresses, and they both kind of lose their cool when they, when they know that something, you know, there's been some bad news coming. But it all leads to her resolution and to this expression of her resoluteness, to her clarity, you know, that what she has seen, what she has experienced in Satyavan is, it transcends fate, I think is the point. But fate is a really interesting concept. There's a kind of implacability here. And, we're now back at the beginning, as it were. And so there's still this year, you know, to test the resolve that she may be mustering, you know, in this moment of hearing this news.
It reminds me also of, while you're talking, Marco, it reminds me of the story of Arwen in Tolkien's Lord of the Rings. So Arwen, I don't know if you know the story, but she's the immortal elf who gives up her immortality to be with Aragorn in the mortal world and to die eventually, so that she can spend her life with him. Otherwise, she couldn't do that. So anyway, it's another story, another great love story about this idea of giving up to be with the loved one. And in relation to that, also, I noticed in the early part of this canto, a great deal of references to the moon in various different ways. And it made me think of the tarot card, the High Priestess, which is, the sort of virgin priestess kind of image, but somebody who has sort of almost infinite power, but hidden within the self. So I don't know whether, you know, whether tarot has any link to Sri Aurobindo's writing, but there are resonances there with that kind of mythology as well.
So the one line that she says, and yet I know this is not all my fate, only to live and love a while and die. So there she makes it clear that the purpose of their union is much greater than what her mother can understand or foresee. That this is not just...
It's kind of funny that... I thought it was kind of funny that she tries to convince her not to continue with, you know, her vow to Satyavan. Can't you find somebody else? Like, so, you know, is it really worth it? And you could feel her, maybe she's been, you know, she's experienced disappointment in the past and just doesn't want to face it again through her daughter's trials, upcoming trial. But yeah, I I there's something more, of course, that Savitri is feeling, you know, than just this kind of brute ruling about the what's going to happen to Satyavan.
It was really powerful in this section of the mother, that because she is a human mother, she cannot tolerate suffering for her child, which is very much something inherent in human mothers. I will speak for that myself. And so she will move heaven and earth for that fate not to be her daughter's fate. So it's really touching how in all these lofty people, that people this book, there is all of a sudden a real human mother expressing her her heart's grief and desire. Yeah.
Going back to the question of fate, in the first part of this last speech of Savitri, she says, "My fate is what my spirit's strength can make. My fate is what my spirit's strength can bear." So she specifically, explicitly challenges the human concept of fate and says she's not bound by it.
Well, it's almost like she's designed to meet it, right?
She's really designing her own fate. And yeah. She's designing the fate of a larger power for humanity in her person. Another thing I think is really interesting is that this next canto, which is going to elaborate. So the next canto is The Way of Fate and the Problem of Pain. It's a long canto, and this is said to be the last canto that Sri Aurobindo worked on. Huh. So he created it late in the game and spent the last time that he worked on Savitri before his passing on this canto.
That's interesting, because a question I have as a reader is Savitri's resolution, resolve, is it true or is it a function of like youth and stubbornness, or and so how malleable is fate and how powerful is the will in the face of fate? Perhaps this is why Sri Aurobindo was working on this question to the end.
Well, it's an ancient question of the problem of evil, so that humanity has struggled with forever. And so Sri Aurobindo spends a good bit of time dealing with that, what that's about, in this next canto.
So I've got here. So I felt there was an awful lot in this canto, and we definitely need to read it again, but not today.
It sounds like we're going to be working with fate for a few sessions here. We'll definitely need another pass through canto one and probably two, three, or four through the next canto, depending on how long it takes to get through it. But it is pretty long, so we might need to break it up into a couple halves. And that's okay with me. But perhaps just our fate.
It should be pretty powerful to, is that just his last canto? That is like, it feels like a really meaningful thing that he wants to give to the world. his insight around the problem of fate and pain, which is a great battle in the human mind.
I know. this is a very, this feels like one of the deepest cantos that we've read so far to me, as far as just looking at the fundamental issues of a human life. And also the responses to it, the kind of stages perhaps of grief, or the stages of acceptance of the reality, but then also perhaps he's offering a creative alternative, or another way of thinking about it, than has been like handed down to us. We shall see.
I also feel that I only get, I don't know, a fraction of it when I read it the first time. and I so appreciate the discussion, because it always gets, it gets me to at least another 100%. I don't know, you know, if I have 20%, I'm now at 40%. I don't say I'm at 40%. Yeah. I'm just saying that I get at least as much out of the discussion than I do out of the first reading. And then, of course, the second reading is, then prepared, as it were, in ways that are really useful. So
then it can land, huh?
Mm-hmm. And for those who've been reading it many times, obviously, I'm still a new reader for Savitri.
The mother said that she, every time she read Savitri, it was totally new. She said, I've never read this before. And she had she said she had already read it 5 or 6 times.
So, well, we know, like John Robert and I, you know, I've read this since 1972. And I still it's still new. I mean, this thing here with the mother, this canto, is very familiar to me. I remember reading it out loud during one of the immersions and being just totally swept away by it. Yeah, very powerful.
Okay. I think the thing that you brought up, Marco, about whether this Savitri's attitude in this canto is, you know, youth that doesn't really know the full meaning of life, or whether it's something more than that. The pretty much most of the part two is dealing with that question. Who is she really, and who is talking when she gets back from her first meeting with Satyavan? We see, so the second part is really Savitri's sadhana.
The second part of the book, yeah.
The second part of the epic is, part two.
That's interesting. Because she identifies this with God. She explicitly says, this is not just a kind of impersonal force, the Titan's force. There's something more, you know, there's something of ultimate meaning and significance involved here. And that's a very strong declaration. I know from my own experience, it's, you know, one can have powerful truths revealed or intuited or known, and they're so clear, and they may be clear for some time, but there's a kind of the day-to-day of life and the struggle to live those truths can test, you know, how firmly one has grasped them, you know, what we could say, or you know, how deeply they've rooted themselves, you know, in one's actual being. I'm glad to hear that we'll be studying that and looking at Savitri's path through that process. I thought I had something else to say, but I think I might leave it there. Yeah,
we will hear echoes of Savitri's mother's, the queen's argument in this canto. We'll hear echoes of that as we go through the rest of the epic, the rest of part two.
I'm glad as a beginner reader, I'm with some advanced beginner readers. I'm glad we have a mix.
Yeah, and it is so delightful. I think I can speak for the two of us to do this with you too. It's because it also makes it new again, even more so for me, at least. Yeah. And witnessing the delight of discovery in the beginner reading.
So I'm just looking at this passage on page 424 when she says, I have obeyed my heart. I have heard its call. I have met on the wild forest lonely verge. My father, I have chosen. This is done. I mean, you know, here is kind of the center of the whole thing, right? It's the moment when the pieces fully engage, right? Or I think so anyway. You know, and it represents a kind of self-knowledge, which is really interesting for her, you know, that I find really interesting. Yeah.
She's also the most succinct of all the speakers. When she says something, it's these tight, like, you know, perfect sentences, you know, of a few words that convey with, no, absolute clarity, like her position, you know, on the matter.
Yeah, she doesn't mess about. She knows what she wants.
Yeah, I was just looking for her earlier statement, just when she had arrived, because it was a similar kind of report. I'll come across it later. But in a way, it's also her the quality of her statements is like a testament to the truth of them, I think. Whereas a lot of the discourse here, particularly when Narad is speaking, is very flowery and it's kind of talking around things. Satyavan, there's this whole, it goes on for so many lines about how great Satyavan is and, you know, how special he is amongst all, you know, all people and so on. And it's, I'm sure, aren't true, but also is part of this sort of dissembling and, you know, deferring, you know, getting to the matter at hand or getting to the real news. So I think she's a real counterpoint, you know, to that style.
A good point, Marco. I like that. She speaks in crystals and Narad speaks in flowers.
Very good. Very good.
Shall we do a meditation and finish up? Is that where we're at?
I think so. I have another meeting at the top of the hour, so it'd be good to have a few minutes transition. I was just looking for that line, but maybe I'll find it later.
Well, we have a few minutes if you want to look, Marco.
Oh, and we'll be doing it again next week. So okay. We'll come back to it.
We'll pick it up next week, next time.
All right. Yeah. Or 2 weeks or three, however it is.
Thank you all.
I was just thinking what a delight it is to be able to meet with you, rained down on by Sri Aurobindo's words, or surrounded, you know, in the net of Sri Aurobindo's words.
Oh. I have to take that comb.
Okay. Thank you so much. Good to read with you as always. Until next time.
Thanks, everyone.
Bye, everyone.
Thank you.
Hello.
Bye-bye.